we moved to Joplin, Missouri. Out of Joplin, a little ways to Prosperity, Missouri, and my mother married again, and we went to Colorado in a covered wagon to Loveland, Colorado, and we stayed there for a while and went back to Missouri and then back to Oklahoma. And I was raised on sharecropping farms in Oklahoma. We rented a place 1 year and we farmed cotton and corn, and then the next year we'd hunt somewhere else, and we moved just about every year for several years. My stepfather left us when I was about 13 years old. He went back to Colorado. He had the miner's consumption from the lead mines in Missouri, and he couldn't live in Oklahoma because he had to have a higher altitude. So that left my mother and us, we children, to make it the best we could. I married when I was 19 years old. I had gone to Wewoka, Oklahoma, and was working in the hotels there where the oil field men lived, you know. And I met my husband there and married him. His name was Del Dunn, and he was from Atoka, around Colgate, Oklahoma, and he was part Indian. And we had one son born in Wewoka, my oldest son, Jay, born the 17th of November, 1927. And then we moved to Hobart, Oklahoma, and my second son was born in Hobart, and my husband worked for $1 a day, and there wasn't much to do. So we left and went as far as Roswell. We sold all of our furniture, which didn't amount to too much. The last thing we sold was a cook stove for $3.50, and we used that money to go to as far as it would go. My husband was so, he didn't understand how far it was to California, seemingly, and he thought that would get us to California, but we got to Roswell, New Mexico, and we stayed there for a while, and I worked in a cafe. And then in the latter part of that was in 30, we came west to California.
Okay, before we actually get into California, could we go back just a little bit and talk about a little bit more about your childhood. Like, how many children were there in your family?
There were four of we older children, my father's children, and my stepfather left my mother before the last child was born, and my mother had four, but one of set was twins. And
eight of
us all together.
When your stepdad left when you were 13, how did you all get along? I mean, how did you support yourselves?
Well, it wasn't easy.
I bet.
We picked cotton and chopped cotton and hunted rabbits. And
so as a 13-year-old, you were already working in the in the fields, and your mother and your brothers and sisters also?
Well, my oldest brother went to my father, and my sister, 2 years older than myself, she married. So that left myself and my younger brother, my own brother, 2 years younger than I, to support my mother and the children. And, of course, we did that with whatever we could find to do.
So you and your brother, you as a 13-year-old and your brother is a
11-year-old.
Took the major responsibility for supporting the family?
Yes.
Wow, that made you grow up in a hurry.
Oh, yes, we grew up in a hurry.
That sounds like it. You lived, were you then still doing sharecropping?
Yes, we moved. We plowed with my brother and I would
find some little place in Oklahoma around close, you know, we would move. And 1 year our house burned. We had a little wood stove, and I guess we had a piece of wood in there that was too long. And we went someplace and left it, I guess, hanging out. It fell out of the stove and set the house fire and burned everything we had up. And the neighbors and friends built us a house. About 8 miles. At that time, we lived about 8 miles from Hanna, Oklahoma. We moved in the neighborhood of around Eufaula and Hanna. I had an aunt, my mother's sister, and her husband lived there, and they seemingly stayed on one place quite some time, but I don't know why. We just moved from one place to another. My brother was 11 years old, and I was 13, by the time I was 15, we plowed with teams of mules, you know, and horses, and planted. We didn't know too much about it, but we did what we could. Mm-hmm. And then we'd pick the cotton in the fall and haul it off, and we'd buy enough food to last. Of course, we raised hogs, and we usually had a cow, and Mother made a garden, and by all of us working, we survived. And then when I was 19, my oldest brother came home, and he didn't seemingly get along with me too good, because he usually came in and sold everything we had, even included horses or mules, and then he would kind of leave us to make do the best we could the next year, you know. So I went to Weewoke and got a job in the hotel. And the first job I got $5 a week in my room and board.
What were you doing?
I was making beds and helping in the kitchen and things like that. But those were very trying times, because I was raised by my mother, which was very strict, you know. We didn't have any drinking in our home, and we didn't have any cursing, and we didn't have any things like the morals that people have today. And when I got into the oil fields, I was astonished at the things that went on and what was expected of people. So the first job I was fired off of, I'd been there about a week, and I was fired because the lady that ran the hotel's grandson, no, it was her nephew, kind of got fresh, and so I was fired. And then I went to some people that I knew in the state about a week, and I had another job, and I got $7 a week.
What year would that have been in?
That would have been 19 and, see, I married in 1927. That was in 1927. And I worked there, oh, I guess 2 or 3 weeks, and I was fired again. But this time, because the lady that operated the place had a husband that was paralyzed from his waist down. He had an accident moving a house. I don't know just what, it fell on him or something. And he asked me to bring a glass of water with sugar, a glass with sugar in it, into the laundry room to him. And I didn't know any better than to take it to him. So I took it to him, and his daughter saw me and told his wife. And she come out and jumped on me. And it seemed that when I learned why, it was because that he soiled himself when he drank whatever he drank. He put something in the glass with the sugar and water. And so she come out and jumped on me, and then she fired me for bringing him the sugar in the glass, which I didn't even realize, you know.
Thought you were doing a good deed.
Yeah. And
tell me a little bit more what it was like for a youngster of 19 who lived in a sheltered kind of farm community to come to an oil field camp town, which was sounds like it was just really wide open.
It was a howling place, a very howling place. I would never have married when I did, and who I did, I think, if I had have had a home. But it was kind of rough out there, you know.
Must have been terrifying when you were there all by yourself,
mm-hmm.
and fired and wondering where your next meal was going.
Mm-hmm. It was very. Anyway, I met this my husband, and he was working in the oil fields, and I was making a bed upstairs is how I met him, and some fellow up there started chasing me around the bed, and my husband was in a room next to it, and he jumped up out of the bed and stopped this man. This is terrible to tell things like this, but it's the truth. And, of course, that made me think more of him, thinking he was so nice, you know, so I married him. However, it was a mistake to marry when you don't know anyone any longer than that, don't know anything more about them than I did. But anyway,
how long
did
you know him?
About 6 weeks.
We do things different than we would have done if we had choices.
Mm-hmm. And so We married him. We woke the 23rd of February, 1927. And my oldest son was born November the 17th, 1927. And we lived in Wewoka for quite some time until, well, he worked in the oil fields, but it seems like he didn't know how or something. He didn't make too much of a living, so we moved to Hobart. And our second son was born in Hobart, Oklahoma. He worked in an oil mill there in Oklahoma, in Hobart. And then things were so tough that he got $1 a day, which made $6 a week. And we tried to exist on $6 a week, and finally we just sold our bed, and we sold our stove, and we had a dresser. We didn't have too much, you know, $3 or $4 here. And first thing you know, it was all gone for food. And we had a stove left, and my husband sold that for $3.50. And we put the gas in the car and took off. And we got as far as Roswell, New Mexico.
How did you live on the way to Roswell? Did you stop in?
We stopped one day, and it was raining so hard, and we had a 27 Chevrolet touring car. And we stopped at on the road at Farwell, Texas. And it was raining, and we were getting so wet. We stopped, and someone invited us into their house with two children. And we stayed all night there in the house. And my husband worked a day or so while we was there, someplace a little ways from there in the wheat or barley or some kind of thrashing. He worked a day or two, and then we used the money to go on to Roswell. And when we got to Roswell, we camped on the Pecos River. We didn't know that the Pecos River overflowed, you know, and had flash floods. But anyway, we were camped there, and we didn't have anything. So my husband, he started out looking for work, and he came home that evening, come back that evening where we were camped, and he said, well, he just couldn't find anything, and I told him to take care of the children, and I'd try. So I went out and washed windows in Roswell, and before we arrived in Roswell, we stopped in Texas. And it seems like to me it was Dallas, but I'm not sure. And we camped in a field under the shade of a tree, and my husband tried to find something to do there. And we were way out in the pasture, if I remember correctly, and some man came riding by on his horse, and wondered what we were doing out there, and I told him I was waiting for my husband to come back. He was looking for a job. He invited me to go to their house or go home with them. I never went, of course, but he seemed to think it was strange that I was out in this pasture sitting down on the ground. And then we went to Roswell, as I say, and we camped on the Pecos River, and someone come along and told us after we'd been there a couple of days, said, you shouldn't park on this river or camp down in here in this river because they have flash floods. And so we decided then that we would move. And we didn't know it, but we moved up the river. And, of course, we were trying to find a shade, you know. And we moved where there were some trees, and we parked on the same river on the other side of town. And but I got a job, and I worked at the Bankhead Cafe. At that time, I never knew that J.C. Penney's, or I didn't know they ever offered credit to anyone, but I needed what they called at that time a hashing apron or a white dress to wear, you know, in the cafe. And first, when I was washing windows, I washed windows for a lady, and she was asking me about where we lived and so forth and all that thing, you know, and I told her, and she bought us some groceries and took me home and took me down where we were camped. And then we moved up on the other side of town on the Pecos River again, and I went to this cafe and asked for a job, and they gave me a job. And I had to have something to wear. I only had one dress. And so I went to J.C. Penney's and asked them, you know, for, and they credited me with a dress to wear. And I worked at the Bankhead Cafe, I don't know how many weeks, and there was a man came in that had a piece of steel in his eye because he'd worked for some business that the steel got in his eye, and he got a settlement from the steel that was in his eye, and he asked me if I would like to go in business with him in a cafe. And he knew of a cafe around the corner on 2nd Street, and they called it the Square Deal Cafe, and he could get it if I could stock it with groceries. Well, we would go in business. So I said, sure. And there was a little store on the road home. I stopped there and asked them if they would credit me with the food, you know, for the cafe. And he said, yes. And so we went in business, and we worked. I was there about 2 or 3 weeks, and we were doing pretty good, but my husband got jealous of the man, and unbeknownst to myself, he sold the business out, my part of it, and said he was coming to California where he could get a he-man's job. And so he got an old Essex car, and $90, he said. I never seen the $90, so I think he must have told me a story about that. But anyway, my mother sent us money to come to California. And we arrived in California somewhere in the fall of the year, because it was cotton picking time, I remember. And so I started picking cotton in California. And we had the two children, my two sons. The youngest one was something over a year old. He was born in December 19 and 29, and he wouldn't have been a year old till December the 10th, and we got here just about the time he was a year old, I would say, somewhere in there. So we picked cotton, and my brother and my husband went to work at Tagus Ranch up by Tulare. They never got any money for it. They gave them some kind of Tagus Ranch money that they had to spend on the ranch. And we were pretty desperate along about then. My mother had the four children that were at home, and they were pretty well, not grown, but pretty good size, you know, and it took a lot of food for all of us. And my baby, they brought some oranges in, and I didn't know that the oranges were frostbitten. I didn't know anything about oranges, you might say, because we had never been around oranges or anything, you know. And they claimed the oranges were frostbitten and the baby took bowel trouble. And in the 17th of June, he died. They wouldn't let us... we took the baby to the hospital, but because we're out of state, and, you know, we didn't belong here, they wouldn't do anything for him. And it was hot, and I had to get someone to take us to Tulare. We lived in Tipton. We had to get someone to take us, and it was so hot, and I would take him, and they wouldn't do anything. They wouldn't help me with him, and he died. Eventually, just before he died, someone called the doctors, and they came out to the ranch, and he was already dying then. And we couldn't save him. And then in September, my little girl was born. The 13th of September. He died the 17th of June, and my little girl was born the 13th of September. In 1931. And we moved from the ranch where we lived into a little house that was vacant. There was no one living in it. We lived there for a while. And my husband, he would work for $1 a day, you know, and try to provide for us, but it didn't seem to do any good.
Before you lived in the vacant house, was that on the Tagus Ranch?
No, my husband and brother went to Tagus Ranch. We didn't live on Tagus Ranch. We lived in Tipton, but my brother and my husband went to Tagus Ranch from Tipton and worked up there and stayed up there.
Oh, and you stayed in Tipton.
And my mother and her family and myself and my children stayed in Tipton, out of Tipton on the Vetter Ranch. Vetter, V-E-T-T-E-R. Mr. Vetter was a fine man. He was a German man, and his family lived in Lomita, California. And he had this ranch there, and he was a very good person. He was a very nice person. Anyway, the first year that I lived on the ranch before my little girl was born, or the year that my little girl was born, I raised turkeys for Mr. Vetter. He had some turkeys, and I raised turkeys for him. I raised 317 turkeys, and of course, by the time the fall came, all over 200 I raised I could have. So he let me take his car and take the eggs to Tulare and buy food, and I raised turkeys for him. That was the year my little girl was born. That was after my baby had died. And that fall, my husband thought that, I guess back in Atoka and around Colgate, Oklahoma, they made booze. I never was where they made booze, but anyway, he wanted to take the money that I got out of that and buy sugar in two or three, I don't know what they bought, but they bought something to make some booze, and that's where the money went. The little bit that I got out of the turkeys. And then we moved off of that ranch and moved into this house that was vacant. And
when you were living on the ranch, was that in a ranch cabin or?
In a one-room cabin. We had a little one-room cabin there, and we lived in that.
With running water and that kind of stuff, or did you have to carry your water?
No, it wasn't modern. No, it was just a cabin in an outside privy, I guess you call it, and you had to carry the water inside and things like that. There was water outside the cabin, but not in the cabin. And I picked cotton that fall when my little daughter was born, the 13th of September. I would take her, I would bathe her every morning, and I'd put her in a wicker basket that I had and take her to the field, and I had a wire that I went over there and a mosquito bar to keep the mosquitoes and flies off of her, and I'd take her and set her on the end of the row and pick cotton. I'd pick down a ways and then back. Then I would move her to the other end or the middle of the field, and then I'd pick down and back so I could watch after her. And that year, they had a strike. It was 1932, I guess it was. They had a strike.
In Tipton, in the...
Well, it was 33, I guess it was, they had the strike. And, of course, my little girl was bigger then, and we were cutting grapes. And it was on the Stark Ranch out of Tipton. And they come and told us, we were down in the field cutting raisin grapes, and they asked us if we weren't going to strike. And we said, strike. And they said, yes. He said, everybody's out of the field but you people. And I said, well, what are they doing? And he said, well, they're striking. And I said, well, what are they striking for? And he said, well, we're trying to get better wages. So we just got up and went out to the end of the field. We didn't even know what a strike was. And then after the grape strike, they had the cotton strike in 33.
Okay, go back to the grape strike. What happened when you all walked off the field?
Well, they told us to go home. So we went home. And then they come along and asked my husband and them, do you want a picket? Well, we didn't know what picketing was, but he said, well, he'd do whatever they could. So he went with them to picket. They picketed day and night over there on that ranch, trying to get wages for cutting raisin grapes.
What were they asking for?
Well, I think they were getting about a penny a tray. I'm not sure what they were getting, because they didn't get 5 cents a tray for several years after that, so I'm sure they only got about a penny a tray. And you'd have to cut 200 trays to make $2. But we were so used to poor wages, $2 a day to us seemed like a considerable amount of money when you worked all day, 12 hours a day for a dollar. And anyway, we moved. We were in that strike, and then we moved from there down to Pixley, out of that place down to Pixley.
Did you ever hear what happened? What was the end result? Did the strikers get anywhere with their demands, or?
I think that they went back to work. I don't think we went back to work. I think what we did, and the best I recall, we went out to cotton picking comes on along about the time the grapes, you know, right after they start in the grapes. And we started picking cotton. And we were getting 40 cents a hundred. And you had to pick 200 pounds to make 80 cents. And I took my little daughter out there in the field, and I hadn't had to watch after her because the cotton was high to keep her from getting lost, you know. So they come and told us that they were striking in the cotton. And so we moved... It was in Tipton. We were living in this little house that we had moved into in Tipton when they had the grape strike. And we came home one evening or one night after we'd started picking cotton, and they had the cotton strike. And all of our things was moved out on the side of the road. And when we drove up there, we didn't have nowhere to go. We were out on the side of the road, you know. So we moved to Pixley. And they set up strikers' headquarters in Pixley, California, and they gathered at this strikers' hall, and the authorities told us not to have any guns or not to have any clubs or anything like that because it was against the law.
Just a minute, Ms. Dunn. We're coming close to the end of this reel of tape, so let me just turn it over before you continue.
We went down to the strikers' headquarters, and the longshoremen from San Francisco, sent food and clothes to distribute to the people. And we helped cook. We had a big stove out back of this track. It used to be the old Chevrolet garage, and cooked, and eventually they started going around the fields because there was some what we called, what they called scabs was in the field. So we started going around the fields with cars, caravans, and they told us that no one had ever yet been able to have a strike in the fields because it was too inconvenient. You had too many places you had to go. It wasn't like a stationary store or something like that. So I began to go with them around the fields. And there was a little Mexican girl. I say a little Mexican girl. She was a little midget. And she would tell me what to say because the people in the field were Mexicans. And she taught me to say, "Walka, walka, pescadores," you know. And I had a loud voice, and I would get the people out of the fields. By then, I was losing some of my being timid about, being oppressed so long, you know. You finally get where you're not quite so timid. And I began to help get the people out of the fields, and then they began to say I was an agitator. And they called me the worst red-headed agitator in Tulare County because I could really get the people out of the fields. And when I saw that I could, and I knew that we could win the strike, and we could get $1 a hundred where you could make $2 a day instead of 80 cents, I thought, well, my goodness, why not? So we won that strike on the 17th of October.
When you say you won, what happened?
They gave us $1 a hundred. But before we won, they told us not to have any clubs or any guns or anything to fight with. And they allowed the farmers to come down there in their cars with their shotguns and all of these things, and the highway patrol turned the traffic, because Pixley was right on the 99 highway, and they turned the traffic over two blocks and let the farmers shoot into this hall where we were at. And when they killed the Mexican council, we had Pat Chambers was one of the men that was down making speeches for us, and Carolyn Decker. I don't know whether you remember them or not.
Carolyn Decker is familiar.
Carolyn Decker and Pat Chambers were the people that was helping us in the strike, and they called them communists. And I had been out in the field where Pat had made, he's standing on the back of a car, of a pickup bed, and was making a speech. And he told us that they were trying to make the streets of Pixley run red with blood, as did the streets of Harlan, Kentucky, in a coal mine strike that they had had. And when we got back to the strikers' headquarters, the farmers were there with their guns, and they began shooting. The traffic had been turned around where the traffic wouldn't come through and get shot, and they shot across the highway and shot into the strikers' hall. Well, when they did this, there was some of the men still out on the street. And the Mexican consul from Mexico and another man tried to wrestle the guns away from the farmers. And they killed the Mexican consul and this other fellow. And they shot eight people that was trying to run from them and flee from them through the strikers' hall. It was a big Chevrolet garage, had been, with these great big doors, you know. And you could drive a car out the back. And these people were running, and they shot right in. They shot one boy in his heel string and made a cripple of him, one woman in the back of her leg. I at the time, was giving my daughter a drink in the back of this place. She was thirsty, and I took her back there. She was getting, I guess, close to 2 years or something like that. She was 2 years old. And I was giving her a drink, and someone said, I thought it sounded like firecrackers. I had never been used to being around guns, you know, or anything like that. Never occurred to me that those people would shoot us. It never occurred to me. I never even thought about it. They had been out there on the street, and I had gone down the street the law enforcement officers had backed off about two blocks, at least a block and a half from there, before Judge Swanson's place of business. And I had seen them down there, and I had gone down there, and I got this Jack Hill, which was the undersheriff, I got him by the arm. And I said, look, even though I said this, I didn't realize they would actually shoot. I said, do you know those men up there have guns? And they're going to shoot those people. And I got him by the arm, and he walked with me as if I was the boss of him. I don't know how came to do it. But I led him right on down the street to the Strikers Hall. And I said, those men are going to kill those people. However, I didn't think they were going to kill him, but I wanted him to know that they had guns, you know, so he could see it. Well, he didn't do anything, and they actually shot and killed two of them. I went on back in the back and got my daughter a drink, and when I heard this popping out there, I really didn't realize it was guns going off. And they began to run, and I looked around, and they said, oh, they're shooting. And I went out the back and got the building between me and the people that were shooting. And then, of course, they had a trial for these people, which was a mock trial. They didn't try to find out what they had done. They arrested Pat Chambers and Carolyn Decker. I think there was, 11 of them of what they call communists. And they had people up there that lied on them, and they gave them, I think, I've forgotten how many years in prison.
Carol Decker and Pat Chambers?
Yes, and some of the others.
So that instead of arresting
the people that
the shooting,
absolutely,
the people that were shot at?
They arrested the people that they call communists, Pat Chambers and Carolyn Decker, and they got a big truck, bus, and we people that knew what Pat Chambers had said, they said he incited to riot. But he was only telling us that the farmers were going to make the streets of Pixley run red with blood, as did the streets of Harlan, Kentucky. Those were his exact words. But they wouldn't let me testify because I was sitting right there. I was sitting with the Mexican consul in his car when Pat Chambers said that. I know what he said. But they never would let me testify because they knew, well, I guess maybe they thought I wasn't afraid, and I wasn't. I didn't really know enough to be afraid. I wasn't so aware of people doing things to people, you know. I just wasn't raised like that. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing and what I was hearing. I knew it was happening, but yet I couldn't hardly believe that people were like that. One man was Smokey Nichols. And one time, they wouldn't even let me in the courtroom, part of the time when they were having trials on those farmers. They barred me from the courtroom, and one time I remember I put on a hat, put on lipstick, which I'd never wore at that time, and dressed up a little different to what I'd been dressing, and with borrowed clothes, and went up, and I was sitting in there listening at the things they were telling. And they just, it was a farce. So then after that strike, they had this, we had to get in the bread lines because your money didn't last too long when you didn't make any in the first place. And they set up what they called a Pixley Food Depot. And the people would stand for 2 and 3 blocks. There was 2 or 3 block long people standing.
Before we get into that part of it, who was doing the organizing? Who were the organizers, the strike organizers?
I can't recall. I should recall, but I can't recall the name of the people. I probably will later on. That I was acquainted with. But they were just like us. They were just people out there working. But Pat Chambers and Carolyn Decker was two that I know that came down there. And they had been over in the berry patches and places over on the coast trying to organize the people over there. And Lillian Munro, after that, she wasn't there at the time, but after that, Lillian Munro came down and trying to tell us people or we people, that there was plenty of vegetables and plenty of meat and food like that instead of what they were giving the people, you know.
Do you remember what organization, or, you know, was there was it part of the AFL or the CIO or any organization like that that was that were trying to organize you that you knew of?
Well, it was, I think, the CIO, but it wasn't called that then. What was it called at that time? It wasn't American Federation of Labor, but it was before what they called the CIO, that's the Congress of Industrial Organizations. But I don't think they called it that. It was some kind of a farmers something. I just don't remember, honey, but it would be in the papers, I'm sure, if you could get the papers of that time.
Okay, and Carolyn Decker and Pat Chambers were representatives of this organization?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So after the trials, then, were you able to go back to work in the fields, or were you blacklisted, or what happened since you were so involved in that?
Well, at the cotton strike, we worked in the fields, but a lot of times they wouldn't let me work because they called me a red-headed agitator. And I don't know, we just, sometimes we'd get a job, sometimes we wouldn't.
How about your husband? What did he think about your being this involved in
Well, he would rather have gone back to Oklahoma and curled up and died than have been in it, you know. But then when we had to go to the bread lines in the winter time, that winter, they told me not to come down there. They said, "Mrs. Dunn, don't you come down, you send your husband." And I said, "Well, I'll send him, but you won't give him anything when I send him." And I said, "If you don't give him anything, I'll have to come down here." So that is where they called us rioting at the Pixley Food Depot. That is the first time that I heard of Lillian Monroe. I started to say Marilyn Monroe. Lillian Monroe. But I wasn't there that morning when this happened. We had an old cow that we were milking from a widow woman, and I had took her some buttermilk because she was sick and she wanted some buttermilk, and I had took her some buttermilk, and they had told me not to come, and I wasn't there. But Francis Hicks and Chuck Harding and Kirby Brooks were there, which were on the order of myself, knowing that we were being abused, you know, Lillian Monroe had been there that morning, and I don't really know what had happened that morning, but later in the afternoon when I went there and it were about time for them to close, I asked my husband if he got any food, and he said they wouldn't give me anything. And I said, "Well, you better get back in line. There's nothing out at the house." And he got back in line, and when he got to the door is one of those that you push. You push so far, and then it bends in. It had a hinge on it that would bend in. And so he got back in line, and when he got to the door, they opened the door for him to come in. Of course, they didn't know who was out there. They opened the door for him to come in. And when he stepped in, I was going to go in too, because I knew they was going to turn him out again, and then they would lock the doors, and nobody would ever get anything that evening, and it'd be 2 weeks before they'd be down there again. So I started to step in, and I put my foot like this, and the door, they started to shove the door to on my foot. And I had to push it in to keep them from mashing my foot. And this man was in there, E.C. Vail was in there. He had this gun on his hip, and he wheeled around where I was at. And I guess when I pushed the door, I evidently did push him. But I didn't know he was there because I couldn't see him, but I had to push the door to keep my foot from getting hurt, you know. So they said, "We told you to send your husband." I said, "I sent him, and you didn't give him anything." And I said, "You better sack him up, because I came after it." I was mad, you know. I finally got to the place that I was sort of belligerent, tell you the truth, because I had just been... And so the supervisor looked over at him. He said, "Sack 'em up, boys." And so they gave us some food. But the food that they gave you was just, I say, tala and split beans full of rocks and dirt and rice. And no telling where you'd come from and things like that. They actually took the vegetables and the fruit out in the country and set them fire and poured oil on it.
They didn't think
they were supposed to be given to us. I mean, they didn't intend to ever give us any fruit and vegetables, you know, because those were supposed to be sold, and they keep them in order to make the food prices. You have to pay for them. I mean, if you don't have money to pay for them, they'll burn them before you eat them. The same thing happened to the meat. They took the cows and the hogs from the farmers, and they paid the farmers for the cows and the hogs, but they didn't give them to the people. They took them out and slaughtered them and told the people, "If you don't, we don't want to catch you with a bit of that meat." Some of the men did sneak around and dig some of it up after it was even buried, but that was the only way they could get it. They couldn't buy it. And they wouldn't give it to them. They'd rather burn it than give it to the people. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. It really is. What about, how did you live that winter of 33 when you, you know, hardly had any work, and it sounds like you couldn't even get the commodities that they were on?
Well, we lived in a eucalyptus grove in a little two-roomed house. And my brother came out here from Oklahoma. My husband wouldn't do it, but my brother and I, we would get out and saw down a tree, and we would cut it up and make stove wood out of it and sell it, a whole cord of wood, for $1.50 or $2 or whatever we could get for it. And, of course, it was just like stealing it, but the people that owned it, some of them lived way off and didn't even know there was a tree out there to cut down. You know, they little patches of land, 5 acres and 10 acres and so forth and so on. And as I say, we milked this cow, and what we could get down at the food depot is what we lived on. And it wasn't easy.
Okay. So were you still living with your mom and her four kids and you and your daughter and your husband?
No. My mother left the first year that we were here and went back to Oklahoma. Then when I say my brother came out, he came out again and came to us. And he and I cut wood, sawed wood with a crosscut saw.
Why would your husband not do that?
Well, he was afraid. He didn't want to be stealing it. He said... it wasn't ours, you know, and he's afraid he'd get arrested. I don't know. He was just kind of timid, scared, and I guess I had to, either had to do it or else.
It sounds like during that time, you really had to be the strong person.
I was. It was it. They told him when I was in jail, and said, "Now, if you'll get her and get her out of California, we'll turn her out." And he came up and he said, "Now, Lillian, we can go back to Oklahoma." I said, "Look, I haven't bothered these people. And I'm right here. I'll stay right here till it freezes over." I really became hardened to what they were doing, you know.
How do you think you got involved in the whole, being such an activist in the strike? How did that all come about for you?
Well, at first, you see, I was very religious in my life. I've always been very, not religious, but I really believed in the Lord, you know. Well, they told us that communists didn't believe in the Lord. The communists were not, they were anti. So I guess I was the only one in that whole group that ever prayed. And when they'd start to have a meeting, they would ask me to lead them in prayer. And but then I became It wasn't that I didn't believe in the Lord after that, you understand? Mm-hmm. But it became a necessity that someone had to do something. People during that time had polio. One man came to me and he said, Mrs. Dunn, said, my wife, I've got two children in Tulare Hospital with polio, and my wife and the baby said is down, and they've got pneumonia, I think. Said, could you take us to Tulare to the hospital? I didn't have any more gas than anyone else had. I had an old car, and I said, yes, I will. He didn't have any money for gas, and I went down to the street where Judge Swanson and Merle Howard had a service station, and the judge was a judge of the little community there, you know. And I asked him to put me in. I didn't say a tank full of gas. I think 3 or 4 gallon. I asked him for 3 or 4 gallon of gas, and they put it in. And when they came for the money, I said, I'm sorry, I don't have the money to give you for this. I'm taking a man's wife and baby to the hospital, and I'm going to furnish the car, and I'm going to expect you to furnish the gas.
And
well, they didn't like it, but they'd kind of got used to me by then, because I'd gotten to the point that there was too much sadness and too much many things going on that wasn't right. And maybe you don't know how a person gets like that, but you do, you know.
In other words, it sounds like you just got to the place where you became outraged over.
And that's right. That's
what
right.
Was happening.
And you asked me how, some things it's kind of hard to talk about, because you asked me how we survived, you know. There was a colored man out there in the country, and he would kill rabbits and give them to us for meat. And I had milked this old cow, and I'd give him milk. And when they had me on the witness stand up there, and they had him, rather, he wanted to be a witness for me, and bless his sweetheart. He got up, and he was an old fellow, and he had a cane, you know. And he didn't wait for them to ask him any questions. He said, this woman is a good woman. He's waving his cane at him, you know. And they said, sit down, sit down. He said, he was telling them how good a woman I was. And they made him sit down and bless his heart. But he knew, you know, that we survived. We had survived. I've heard of people eating cockroaches. I never ate any of those. But I ate plenty of rabbits.
When you say that he was a witness for you, what were you arrested for?
Rioting at the Pixley Food Depot at the time that I told you I pushed the door and went in. That evening after we got home with what groceries, if you call them groceries, that we got, Delos Howard came out. He was the constable, and he's a lovely person. And he came out, and he said, Mrs. Dunn, I hate to do this, but he said, I've got a warrant for your arrest. And he said, I've got to take you, and I don't want to do it, but I got to. And I said, oh, that's all right, Mr. Howard. So he took me to Visalia. They arrested me for rioting. And Lillian Monroe knew that I wasn't there, see. She knew that they had confused my name with hers, because she was the one that had actually gone down that morning and told them that there was plenty of meat in the country and plenty of vegetables for the people to have a proper diet. But I hadn't been there. I didn't even know this had happened until after they had arrested me. And she went over to Mike Kearney, a farmer that lived over in Waukena. And she told him that they had arrested a lady by the name of Lillian Dunn. And she said, really, they're after me, but they don't know it. And he said, well, you go turn yourself in. I said, don't you let that woman step there. She said, oh, I won't do that till I make bail. And so he got in his car, and he came to Visalia and made bail. He had a 40-acre ranch, and he hocked his ranch for me. And they let me out, but they never got her, because they still didn't know that they were after her instead of me. Because I hadn't rioted. All I had done is just told them that I'd come after some food. There wasn't anything out in my house, and I had to have food for the children.
So that they weren't actually arresting you for forcing your way into the food line or into the building. They were arresting you for what Lillian...
Monroe had did that morning. But when they started to prove it, see, and they found out that they had had the wrong person, they then tried to make a case out of me coming in there. And they actually said, the judge said, this was his exact words, and you can find it in if you ever try to find it. There was no riot and no evidence of a riot, but a deep underlying principle involved that must be considered, which is communism. And so my Kearney bailed me out, and Francis Hicks was with us, Monroe, that morning, and Chuck Harding and Kirby Brooks, they arrested all four of us. But they got the wrong women, they got me, but they didn't know they did until after it was over with, because I had told them when I got in there, I said, well, I wasn't even there. I never... didn't really know that this Lillian Monroe was there either, see, because I hadn't been there. But they let us out on bail. They bailed us all out. And in just a few weeks, they put us back in again for trial. And they came down and bailed me out. He bailed me out about three times. Every time I'd get there, well, he bailed me out.
Why do you think he did that?
Mike Kearney?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he said, he liked me. He said, that woman is just the kind of a woman that I like. He told the judge, he said, Judge, don't you like her? He says, she just suits me. But the thing that he said that about, when they sent them out to give us probation, because they knew we hadn't done anything and they couldn't prove anything. But they went to Chuck Harding and Kirby Brooks and Francis Hicks, and they all told them, said, you go to Mrs. Dunn and whatever she tells you. That's what we'll do. And so when he come to me and I said, look, I didn't do anything. And I said, if I've done anything, you put me in jail. And if I haven't done anything, you're going to turn me loose. I said, you're not going to put me on no probation. No way. So he went back and then they called us in to vice sale in. And that morning, they had, after all this ruckus, they had decided to give us some meat. But the meat that they gave to us was decaying when they gave it to me. Chunk about like this, wasn't fit for human consumption, so I rolled it in paper, and I took it up there, and I sat out on the outside until they called us in. And when we went in, he said, have any of you anything to say before we sentence you? And I said, Judge, I have something I would like to show you. And he said, okay. And I got up and walked up to his desk, and I laid it down on his desk, and he was sitting in his swivel chair like this, and he said, I've seen all that communist propaganda I want to see. And I said, Judge, this isn't communist propaganda. And so he sat there and watched me unwrap it, and when I got it up, it was this decayed meat, you see. And I raised it up, and I was just going to show him what they were giving us to eat, but he started swiveling back, you know, and going back. And I said, Judge, they could have given this to us when it could have been eaten. But they waited till it was decayed, you see, before they gave it to us. Well, he started back like this, and I said, well, come on, Judge, and smell of it. I said, you should be able to smell of it if you expect us to eat it. And he began to gavel for the bailiff to get me out. The bailiff liked me too, bless his heart. And he was making out like he was trying to get to me, but he was going around different seats, you know, weaving his way through the crowd to come where I was. And Mr. Kearney was there, and Mike Kearney said, Judge said, don't you like her? Says she just suits me. And finally, by the time the bailiff got where I was, there was a whole row of reporters sitting down here, and they didn't have swivel seats, you know, and they had never printed the truth in those papers. Actually, they called me a red-headed agitator. I wasn't red-headed. They said I had 8 children, and I only had 3. You know, that sort of thing. They made me, oh, really, a boogaboo out of me. And so I said to each one of them, I showed, under the nose, I just walked down through with. I said, now smell of this and see if you can get this in the paper like it is. I said, you haven't printed the truth since you've been printing that paper. Now, I had gone from, you see how you could get, when you're oppressed so much, you become.
I can just picture you doing that. I think that is something neat. That is really great.
And anyway, that's the way that happened. But anyway, I was pregnant when they had me in jail. My son was about 4 months with my third child there.
Okay, let me take a new tape because we're just about out of tape again. Done 2/14/81. Okay, Mr.
Son. Speaking of hurting your children, my oldest son went to school and of course, the word communist, you know, they have really blown that thing out of proportion. That word communism is a come-on gimmick for the United States of America. It's the biggest farce. Pardon me if you think I shouldn't say it, but it's the biggest farce that this country has ever known. And during the time that all this was going on, they got the Archbishop Hanna from San Francisco to come down to talk to us, to find out what we poor people wanted. And they had him come to Visalia, and he got up and he looked at us and he said, "Well, what do you people want anyway?" And I said, "Well, I'll tell you, I'd like to at least have enough to eat and enough to wear, and maybe a piece of linoleum on the floor so I wouldn't get slivers in my feet." You know, that wasn't too much to ask, was it?
No.
And by calling us communists, and the whole town, they didn't know what even communism was. Actually, people don't know what communism was. It actually means that the means of production be in the hands of the people. And if production had been in the hands of the people, then we wouldn't have let them bury those cows and hogs while we went hungry. And they couldn't have took the oranges and the vegetables out and poured oil on them and set them afire while there was people who were hungry because they didn't have money. Don't you see what I mean?
Yeah.
They couldn't have done that. But it wasn't in the hands of the people. Yet, when every one of my three boys grew up, they come out and said, "It's time to fight for your country." The same children that they tried to starve to death, that didn't have any place in California, is the very people that come to say to fight for your country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what part of this country belongs to the people that don't have any land, and don't have any home, and don't have any money? Now, how in the name of God does anyone's reasoning tell you that you can go out here and confiscate a young man's life for his country when he don't even have the money to buy himself a home? When they raise the interest, if he could buy one, he'd take him every bit of his life working himself to death to pay for it, to have a place to live. And my little kids went to school, and they mistreated them in school because their mother was a communist. And I didn't even know what communism was. Like the judge said to me, "Mrs. Dunn, are you a communist?" I said, "Judge, I never heard that word before. I don't know what communism is. But I said, if it means to have enough to eat and enough to wear is communism, I was born like that." And so I happened to walk down in town while they had a recess or while they'd eaten dinner there one day during the time we were having this trial. And I walked into the store, and the man in the store said, "Well, how's that trial coming down there?" He said, "Why, them people didn't do anything." He said, "That's a farce." He said, they don't have anything to hold them people for at all. They were talking about it in Visalia. It was because the people were naked and destitute and hungry. The very people that they'll tell you today that should get out and fight for this country, they don't have a crying dime.
So it sounds like what you were saying is that at that time, one of the ways that they attempted to gloss over the wretched living conditions of the people was by saying this is all communist agitation.
It's communist agitation. When you have to pick 100 pounds of cotton for 40 cents, and you have to take a little child, a year and a half or 2 years old, out in there and let it stand out in that cotton field all day, and all you can pick maybe is 200 pounds at the very most, there's something wrong with your country, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because you're a communist. If that's communism, I was born like that.
Wrong word, I think.
So, I don't know.
What was the outcome of the trial?
Well, they gave me, 2 weeks? And I can't think to give Francis Hicks 6 weeks. And Kirby Brooks and Chuck Harding, that hadn't done anything at all, they gave them 6 months.
In jail. You spent 2 weeks in jail?
Oh yeah, when they had to do something, how could they use the taxpayers' money and put up a big deal like that without doing something? The judge said, these people, said, I've tried to be good to these people, and he said, I'd like to give them probation, but said, they won't accept probation. Well, I had told him, if I'd done anything, put me in jail. If I hadn't done anything, turn me loose. Why should I go out and have to report to a probation officer when I hadn't done anything?
What did they actually find you guilty of?
Nothing. He said there was no riot, no evidence of a riot, but a deep underlying principle involved, which must be considered, this is exact words of the judge, which is communism.
So, the way he said that, it sounds like he put you in jail for being a communist?
Yeah. Deep underlying principle involved for being a communist.
What did that do to you? What did you feel like when that all happened?
Well, I felt like if that was communism, and knowing myself, and knowing what I'd gone through, if this is communism, I like communism better than what they've got. Now, frankly, that's exactly the way, and I still feel that way.
Yeah, if communism means having enough to eat.
And enough to wear is communism, then I was born like that.
Were you bitter or hostile or angry when this happened to you?
No, I was going to church, you know, and they was having a little revival there in Pixley, and I always sang, and there was a girl played the piano and a boy picked the guitar, and we really enjoyed ourselves going to church, you know. And I had ruptured appendix at that time, and I didn't know. I came home one night and I had appendicitis, and I woke up in the night, and I must have been unconscious, because I never would lay and let anything run on the floor, you know. But I woke up, and this was running off on the floor out of my mouth, and I just come home from church that night. Anyway, we got the doctor, I think it was the next night. I got so sick, I said, would someone go down and get Dr. Syberth? And he came out, and my Bible was laying on my sewing machine, and he set his little bag down there on top of the sewing machine. He said, Mrs. Dunn, do you read this Bible? And I said, yes, why? Well, he said, I thought you was a communist. Isn't that stupid? Isn't that stupid? He thought I was a communist. They had even brainwashed a doctor with the intelligence and the schooling that a doctor gets. They had even brainwashed him that I was a communist. He came, it was after night when he came, and when he saw that Bible, he said, do you read this? And I said, sure, why? He said, well, I thought you was a communist. Can you meet that? And then when I went to the hospital, I nearly died with ruptured appendix. They let me lay there all day until the next night. The doctor said, go to the hospital in the morning if your side still hurts. And they come in and ask me, said, well, Mrs. Dunn, would you just lay here and tell us a lie? And I said, well, I don't think I would. But my side doesn't hurt now, and I don't think it ever did. And my appendix had already ruptured, and they looked, and I was just about gone. They had to give me a spinal to operate on me. But I survived, honey. That's the main thing. I have survived.
You sure are. Where where were you in the hospital?
Tulare.
You were living in Pixley at the time.
At the Pixley, mm-hmm. Pixley, California.
Still living in your cabin in the eucalyptus grove?
No, we paid $13 down on a house and paid it out at $10 a month. It was just a little shack, but it was better than the house in the eucalyptus grove. We didn't have, I think we did have a little sink in the kitchen. I had a little oil stove to cook on.
Was that in Pixley?
Pixley.
What year would that have been?
Well, that would have been about 38 and 39.
So, what year was this whole trial thing going on?
It was in 34.
So after you finished up with all of that and you spent your 2 weeks in jail, let me stop right there. What was it like for a woman to spend 2 weeks in jail in 1934? What was that experience like for you?
Well, I'm not familiar with jails, but this was a nice place. I mean, it was so much nicer than where I lived at home. It was so much nicer than what I had at home. I can't even recall what kind of food I had. You'd think I could, but I couldn't because my brother heard about it in Oklahoma, and I don't know how he got out here from Oklahoma, my older brother. And he came to the jail, and he was so broken up. They said, Mrs. Dunn, your brother's here to see you, and they took me into the room. And he thought I had disgraced the family, you know. He said, Sister, he said, now you know Mother didn't raise you like this. And I said, I haven't done anything. He said, well, now, Mother didn't raise you like this, you know. Well, I hadn't done anything. What could I do about it? Mother didn't raise me like that.
Did your husband watch the children during that time?
No, there was some, well, yes and no. My little daughter stayed with the Harders in Tulare. They were communist people. You know, I found most precious people were communist. You know, they called me a communist, and so this drew the people to me that I didn't even know existed. So they took care of my little daughter, and my husband took care of my son. And there was some Jewish people in Tulare. I don't remember what their names were, but they had a store there, and they got my little girl some shoes. They dressed her up and fed her and took care of her and made pictures of her and everything, you know. Real nice. So if I lean toward communism, don't think nothing about it, because someday, somewhere, somehow, this country's got to know the difference between people that are naked and destitute and hungry. And if that's communism, they're going to have to know what communism is.
I think that when people see a chance to make a better way for themselves, a better life for themselves, it doesn't matter what it's called, that will be the direction
yes.
you need to go.
When, yeah.
when you're desperate and you've got nothing to lose.
You've got nothing to lose, honey.
So during this whole trial thing, you stayed in Pixley then in 33, the strike was in Pixley, and you stayed there until what year?
We stayed in Pixley till 1940, and we moved to Delano.
You started to talk about a little bit earlier that your children were mistreated because of...
Well, you see, my oldest son was going to school, of course, before my daughter was. Because the little boy that died in between, you see, made my daughter a couple of years almost more than, about 4 years younger than the boy. And he would go to school, and they would taunt him and chase him and things like that. And he wouldn't tell me. I didn't know it at the time, because I would have been furious had I known it at the time. But he tells me now, and it's still an ache in his heart, you know. However, he's... I got four lovely children. This is him in this picture up there. Up here, honey, where the boy and the girl.
The wedding.
Mm-hmm.
So he must have been, what, about five or six?
About six.
What did they, just, mostly it was because you were communist? Or
because everybody talked about me being a communist. You see, if that had happened now, and me with the knowledge that I have now, at that time, I was just kind of dashed out there and called a communist when I didn't even know anything about politics. I didn't know anything about people's belief or anything. I wasn't raised for all this was going on. And had it happened now, I would take them to task for it.
Who defended you in that?
Oh, an ACLU. I think the same one, and I can't remember his name, but when I hear it, I know it. I think the one that defended the people that went over to the trials in Nuremberg, Germany. What was his name?
Oh, me.
He was a very famous person. He came out to the house while I lived in... I guess we did, you know, just an old splintered floor and two little... Actually, one large room about like this, and then a little cubby hole about like this where you could hang your clothes and things. And, yeah, he was all right. He was all right. But I got a good education out of that.
Kind of a hard one, wasn't it?
It was hard. It was hard. But you know what I've discovered? And I want to say this for the record. There is a religion in this land that is the arch enemy of communism. And now, in this age, some of their priests and some of their nuns are beginning to see that communism isn't so bad, that the Catholic Church has been persecuting the people for centuries. That's actually the head of the whole thing, the persecution. That is exactly is what's causing the United States to have a war with Russia. Not that Russia is doing anything to us, but they are so afraid that the philosophy of the Russians... I'm not saying that Russia's right. I've never been there. People say, well, are you a communist? You want to go to Russia? Yeah, you should go to Russia. Well, I would like to go to Russia. I would like to see what they have. I would like to see if they're telling us all the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, or if they're propagandizing the people in the United States to make them willing to fight Russia and be wiped off the face of the earth. I'd like to know, because I can't see that they're doing to us what we're trying to do to them. Even the strike in Poland today, we have strikes in the United States, and the United States isn't up in arms about anyone striking the United States, but they've got their eyes glued on Poland simply because it's a religion. It's a religion.
So you think the Catholic Church is so terrified of communism that they're kind of the one that is behind all of the...
The United States is the last Catholic stronghold in the world. And they're using the United States and people that doesn't even know what they're fighting for to combat communism, just like they did in Vietnam. I tried to write a book, and I didn't do a good job of it because the lady that was supposed to fix it for me, I mean, helped me with it. She was a Catholic, and I asked her before we started when she found out all that I had in the book, she tried to keep me from even obtaining the book at the end of time. I called it The Great Indictment. And in this book, I gathered from Kern County Library and the secret societies of all ages in different places the attitude of the Catholic Church and her doctrine and how she feels about communism and the Jesuit Society and the CIA and all of this, and I have it, you know, and I just Xeroxed it off. I'm not a writer because I don't really know how to go about writing, but I've Xeroxed it off and compiled it in a book. And we have the Jesuit Society in the United States has all these universities, and they're a hotbed for the CIA. They're CIA agents, actually, that are infiltrating these other countries where these poor people are in jail and where they call them terrorists and so forth. People can't help them being terrorists if their country is starving them to death, you know. Mm-hmm. You have to be something. You've got to get up in arms somewhere. Someone has to do something. You just can't say, well, today you pick cotton for 40 cents a hundred. Next year you're going to do it for 30, and the next year for 20, and next year for 10, and eventually you'll be doing it for nothing. Yeah. You see what I mean? And you can't do it that way, honey. It can't be done that way. Before you leave here, I'll give you one of them. You probably won't...
I would like to see it, though. I would really, I'd be interested in their, what you've gathered together. I like to backtrack quite a lot and talk a little bit about what was it that made you decide to come to California versus any place else when you decided to leave Oklahoma?
My mother was here, and they had written us, and they thought the conditions here were so much better than they were there. And, of course, she sent us a little bit of money for gas, and we were in Roswell, and my husband had sold out the little old place that I'd tried to have a little business, you know, and he didn't want me working there no more, and he didn't have a job, and what do you do?
So, but actually, how did your mother decide to come to California? How did that all come about?
Well, my oldest sister and her husband were coming, and my mother decided to come along with them with the kids, because my sister's husband kind of helped guide the family. And of course the boys were growing up, and she had three boys and one girl, and one set of twins was a boy and a girl, and so she brought them out here. And the year that we came, they left, and my brother-in-law and sister had already went back to Oklahoma by the time we got here, and left my mother and my brothers out here, you know. And then the next year They left. They were here when my little boy died, June the 17th, and right after that they left. And they went back to Texas and then Oklahoma.
So, at the time that you were in Oklahoma, were you... your husband was unemployed at that time, or was he was in the oil fields then?
When he and I married, he worked in the oil fields.
Mm-hmm.
And then he worked in a garage, just tearing down cars. And he only made a dollar a day, which seems ridiculous, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You can't hardly believe that, can you?
So, what made all the Oklahomans, or many of the Oklahomans, decide that they wanted to go to California? What kinds of things do you think that brought people in such huge numbers from Oklahoma?
Well, there was a drought for one thing, and the Dust Bowl. I mean, the time of the dust storms, you know, they had there. Well, you could find any number of houses just boarded up, along nice houses out on ranches or farms. We call them farms there, and they were just boarded up. The people couldn't survive. There would be sand up the side of the house, knee deep or over, where the sand would blow up against the houses, just beat all the paint off the houses. I don't know whether it was because that they had farmed wheat and it hadn't rained enough, or just what made, but it blew all the topsoil off of the land. And Oklahoma was never too much of a farming country to begin with, because the streams cut ditches, and they didn't have the wisdom and knowledge to terrace it to keep it from cutting gullies through there, or just what, I don't know. But every place we ever lived, there'd be where the water would rain, it'd cut great big ditches and gullies, and eventually, you know, it washes the topsoil out. But
We farmed, but I'm telling you, maybe we'd make a couple of bales of cotton a year, and I never did even know what they got for a bale of cotton, maybe a couple $100 at the very most. Maybe we'd make $400 a year, and that's no money.
No. So you were living, before you moved to the oil camp, you were living on a sharecropping.
Sharecropping. We didn't have any money to rent a place, so we would just give them so much, a half. I think we gave them half of what we made to live in the house and farm the land. Sometimes we'd get a place that have a little hay, a little prairie hay, that they could bale up for the horses and cows. And alfalfa was hardly known back there in those days. And the cotton would be growing on land that didn't have too much topsoil to it. And corn the same way. You usually planted your corn down where the soil was better, close to the rivers or creeks, whichever you happen to live close to, you know. And we sawed our own wood for the winter time, and sometimes we had to carry water from the creek to wash dishes and all that sort of thing. Sometimes it was a well, and sometimes it was a cistern where the water ran off of the house. I remember one time I had chills and fever because we had a cistern and the water ran off of the house into the cistern. And it got full of wiggletails, and we didn't even know that. I guess we were a very ignorant bunch of people. I tell my son that. I said, we were so ignorant.
You were so young, too.
Yes, it was kind of bad.
So at 11 and 13, you and your brother were doing all of these things. You were putting in the crops and... And you have an older brother, though. Where did he go?
He went to my father's. My father moved up close to Tulsa, and he went there. And my sister, she wasn't going to be caught in the shuffle, so she married. She married at 15. So that left my brother and I, and someone had to take care of my mother. She wasn't capable of taking care of herself, so someone had to, you know.
Well, it sounds like you were a strong person right from the very beginning.
I have been. I've never been sick very much in my life. Actually, I never took medicine. I don't today. I don't have a... In this house, you find a lot of people with pills in every crook and cranny. There's no pills in my house. Actually, you know, Judy, I've known the Lord, you know, all of my life, since I was 13. And if it hadn't been for him, I'd have never made it.
Give you your strength to go on, huh? When you were 19 and your brother came back and sold out all of your equipment and everything, how did you come to the decision to move to the oil camp that you moved to?
Well, I didn't really want to tell that, but some things hurt too bad, you know. My older brother wasn't happy with my mother leaving my father. And he didn't like my mother marrying again, and he didn't like my little half-brothers and sisters. But I felt like that they couldn't help being here, you know. And he had been gone all summer, and he came home, and he started fussing with my oldest half-brother. It was a very precious little thing, you know. And I was all that there was there to stand between him and my older brother. And my older brother would whip him if I didn't do something about it. And when he'd go to the table to eat, he'd fuss at him. Just fuss at him, you know, eating and what have you. And so this particular morning, I'd fixed breakfast, and my mother was in the living room or in the other room and sitting close to the stove, and he said he was jumping on my oldest half-brother, and I said, now leave him alone and let him eat. And my brother was crying, you know. And so he jumped up from the table, and he went into the living room, and I hate to say these things. These are hurtful things. But he grabbed up the poker, poked the fire with it, and he drew it on my mother. And I tackled him. He was 7 years older than I. But that didn't make any difference. It was my mother he was jumping on, you know. And so I tackled him. And I didn't fist fight. But I had the strength and the power to keep him from hurting my mother, see. So I wrestled him up in the corner, and my little brother that he had been jumped on, he could run in there with a butcher knife, and he said, "Here, sis, and use this on him." And he handed me the knife, and of course that scared my brother, and he went out of the house and jumped off the porch and went up to another town up there, Hitchity, where my grandfather had lived, and wrote back and told my mother that he could sell the team of mules that we had if she'd bring them up there. So my mother, we had two teams of mules, and so she took the white team of mules and an old hack that we had. An old, you know what a hack is. It's one seat and a bit behind. And she went out there, and she stayed a couple of days, and she came back, and she brought the team of mules and the hack back. And I said, "Well, Mother, I thought Luther was going to sell them while you were gone." She said, "Well, he didn't want to sell the team of mules. He just wanted to talk with me." And she said, "He told me he would stay next year and make a crop for me." He said, "If you didn't stay," he said, "he could get along with all of us but you, but he couldn't get along with you. And if he stayed, you couldn't, and if you stayed, he wouldn't." So I said, "Well, what did you tell him?" She said, "Well, I told him he could make a crop for us." And so I left.
The town that you went to, I've forgotten what the name of it. It has a funny name.
Wewoka.
Yeah, Wewoka. How did you choose Wewoka?
I had a boyfriend, and he had gone up there to work in the oil fields, and he had come home and told us, you know, that he thought, I guess, he was making good money, because he was like us, we were all poor, you know. He was a very nice person, and he had told me, and I thought, well, I'd go up there where he was at. But I got up there, and I didn't find him right off. I mean, I didn't know where to find him, how to find him, dummy. But
how did you make the trip? Where did you get the money to make the trip?
That's some more sad stuff. Well, when my mother let my brother, when my brother came home, he had sold all the corn that we had and all the cotton that we had picked, and did everything that we didn't have much, but I didn't even have a pair of shoes. It was winter time. And rubber things you wear when things are wet. I've forgotten what you call them, but they're big things, men's shoes, and they buckled them and those sort of thing. And Mother had an old cook stove. These are terrible things, you know. She said, "Well, if you sell that stove," said, "you can buy yourself a pair of shoes." So I went around trying to sell that stove, me a kid, 19 years old, a girl trying to sell a stove to get a pair of shoes. Anyway, when she told me that he was going to stay, I went over to my aunt's, her sister, my mother's sister, and we went out in the field and we picked their cotton. It was wet and snow would be on the ground, but you could pick the bowls of cotton would be dry when the ground was still, had snowed, you know, and it was still wet and soaky in the centers, but you could pick the cotton. So we'd pull the bowls off and we'd take them into the house and we'd pick the cotton out of the bowls in the house. So we did this. It took us several days to get a load of cotton or for my uncle to take to town. So he went to town with his load of cotton, and while he was there, someone told him that somebody there needed someone to to work in someone's house. I don't even remember the people's name. So when he come back, he told me that he'd found me a job, $3.50 a week. So when we got another load of cotton ready to go, I went to town and I worked a week for these people, $3.50. Believe it or not, I was making money. And of course, at that time, the fare on the train wasn't too much, and I used that to go to Wewonka. And I stayed one night in a hotel, and the lady told me that they needed someone at this one I told you where I got fired. Mm-hmm. Well, they had this, she said $5 a week, room and board. Well, instead of having a room, the hallway went down, and at the end of the hallway, they put this bed. And the girl that cooked and myself were supposed to sleep in here, and all these doors along here where the men slept. Well, you know, I was raised in the country, and we never did those, nothing like that. I mean, it just wasn't, well, it just wasn't even thought of, much less did. So this particular night, the girl that cooked, she went to the show or someplace, and this nephew of this woman's came to the bed. And he wanted to know if I had the clock, and I told him, yes, I had the clock, and he sat down on the bed, and he started smartening it off, and I said, if you don't get up, I'm going to tell your aunt on you. He said, my aunt don't care what I do. And finally, I told him, I said, if you don't get up, I'm just going to kick the daylights out of you. And he did, but the next morning, she fired me. But they let me know right off that that's the way the girls made their money. That's the way they made their money.
Prostituting on the side.
You work for them to have the bed to sleep in so you could get the money from the boys as working in the oil fields.
Oh, must have been quite a rude awakening for a 19-year-old.
It was for me, I tell you for sure. So I went down. I knew had been there with the preacher and his wife in that town once before. I used to sing in church, you know, and they would come for me because I had a fairly decent voice. So I had been there in a revival one time with this preacher and his wife, and I knew some people that lived there, that the minister and his wife of the town, so I went down to their place. That's the only place I needed to go. And I stayed down there about a week, and she finally found me this other job in this Schultz Hotel, is what they call it. And this hotel had it was built with two doors facing the street. The one here where you had the dining room and the kitchen back and back and where the people cooked the pies and cakes for the people that worked out. And then you go out this door and you go down here and you come into this door, and that's where they had the beds upstairs and downstairs and so forth. And they paid $7.50 a week. Or seven, I've forgotten whether it's $7 or $7.50. And I thought, wow, that was $2 or $3 more than I'd been getting, and all right, you know. And the first, I was supposed to sleep with the girl that did the day's cooking. Well, the first couple of nights, we had the bed together. Of course, I'd been used to sleeping with my sister, you know, that sort of thing, and that didn't bother me. I didn't really know any better. Now I can't sleep with nobody, but then at that time, I didn't know any better. So about the third night, fourth or something like that, I'm forgetting how long, but anyway, I went back in there to go to bed. And there was a man in the bed with his gal. And when I opened the door, and he said, well, come on, kid. He said, I can take care of both of you. So I just closed the door and went back into the dining room and down into the kitchen. And there was a woman and her daughter that made pies and cakes and things, desserts for the men that went to work, you know. So I went back in there and sat down. And I thought, well, I'd stay in there until he left. I didn't know to tell nobody, and if I'd have told anybody, they'd have probably fired me. But you know, I didn't know people were like this. Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah. It was crazy, honey, really crazy.
Did you ever find your boyfriend that you went to when you woke
up? Yes, eventually, but I'd already found this man.
You already found Phil, so. Okay. How about if we stop there for now? you've got so much to say that I would really like to come back again and talk with you some more if it's not too painful.
That's all right, honey. I'll manage next time. Maybe it won't be so bad.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mrs. Dunn, in our last interview, I think we had gotten you through the strike up in the Tipton-Pixley area, and that was in 1933, as I recollect.
Yes.
Okay. Could you recall for me what it was like in living conditions for you in the 1935,
36, 37
years?
Well, there was not too much difference through those years, but until we had the president, you know, elected, what year that was, that he kind of changed the atmosphere of the people here, if you want to call it atmosphere, that was going on in that period of time. After Hoover was out, we seemed to have a little work. He provided jobs, and things began to pick up some after that period of time.
So that would have been in the late
30s? I don't recall. I guess it sounds foolish, but I don't recall when he was, but it was after the Hoover area that...
Yeah, okay. It was Roosevelt that you're talking about.
I'm talking about Roosevelt.
What did you think of Roosevelt as a president?
Well, I think just anything beat Hoover, and I'm not sure, according to the conditions today, that the President of the United States at any time has too much control over what goes on. It seems like that we have, to me it seems, that there's people that conspire to bring on depressions and to control the money, and I'm not educated well enough to understand and know the workings of the government. But in later years, I've been noticing that that I believe that the people are manipulated, and that the president, even though he would like to do something, some of them I don't believe have ever tried to do anything too much, but those that have tried, and I wouldn't say, I used to blame Hoover for everything, but knowing the things that are going on today, I wonder if he had good advisors, or if he was able to do anything more than he did. I really don't know. Maybe he didn't understand what to do. But I think we are manipulated in the United States. You can't have, to me, you can't have as a great number of people that are millionaires and billionaires in a country that haven't contrived by fair or foul means to take it from someone else. And when you have a group of people that are in abject poverty, and you have millionaires and billionaires in a country, there has to be some disparity there. As far as I'm concerned, I think there's a manipulation. I think there's a conspiracy. And I wouldn't be able to tell you who. It would take someone that knows more about it than I do.
What do you think that Roosevelt did during that time that was helpful to the migrants or the field workers?
Well, he provided jobs for one thing.
In what way?
Well, he had the CC camps and the WPA projects. There was sewing projects for women. I worked on a sewing project, and my husband, he had worked on a WPA project to help building the airport around Delano there. And there was some of the young people that went to CC camps and lived away from home to have living, make themselves some money. And I think that he kind of pulled the country out of the doldrums. I'm not sure that Hoover could have did it or why he didn't do something. I really don't know. I never could understand why they killed off the hogs and the cows and buried them before the people could have them to eat when they were perfectly good
good meat and produce, you know.
That was during Hoover's administration?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, did you stop working in the fields then? You said you worked on a sewing project.
I worked on a sewing project. Exactly, I don't remember at the time. I lived in Pixley at the time that I worked on the sewing project. So that was before 1940. Because we moved from Pixley in 1940. Mm-hmm. And we moved to Delano. And in Delano, they had packing houses where they packed lettuce and different vegetables. And at the time, the AFL-CIO, or the CIO, I don't think that was that time they had gone together, had a union, and you couldn't work unless you belonged to the union. And they had them pretty well, the union had them pretty well sewed up, you know, till no one could hardly get in the packing house. And I had gone to Salinas, a friend of mine and I, thinking we might get learn how to trim lettuce and make some money that way. But we couldn't get a job there because you couldn't even talk to the boss. They wouldn't even stop to talk with you to get a job. They'd just start walking across the house, and you'd just have to walk along, hang on to them to talk to them. And, of course, I never was a person that could do that. But then they opened up the packing houses in Delano after we moved there. It must have been about 41, I guess. And I made several trips to this particular packing house to see if I could get to trim lettuce, because they made, at that time, pretty good money. They worked piecework, you know. And the boss, he wouldn't stop to talk with me. And I'd made several trips, and finally the man that owned the packing house said to me, I went there one day at noon, and the packing boss wasn't there. And I said, young lady, can I do something for you? And I said, well, yes, I guess you can. I'm trying to get a job, but this packing boss, he won't stop and talk with me. And I said, I just can't run across the house trying to tell him that I want to work, you know. So he told me, well, he said, he'll be back about 1 o'clock. He's gone to Bakersfield, and when he comes back, I'll have him stop and talk with you. And you'll be back around 1. And I came back at 1. And his name was Steve Antonell. And he was a very fine man, Swede Antonell. And when I came back, and I walked up there, he turned a lettuce crate down, and he put his foot on it and put his elbow on his knee, and he talked with me, and he said, he'll be back in the morning, and I'll put you to work. And so the next morning when I went back, he put me to work. He even got in the line and trimmed the lettuce to show me how. And, of course, the union people that were there, they were pretty well upset. They kind of snickered and said, well, said he must want her to work pretty bad. He must want her to work pretty bad. But, of course, that didn't bother me because I really did want to work. I wanted to work pretty bad, you know. But anyway, then I worked for Roddenberry and Monica in Delano and a number of the packing bosses. And from then on, I was able to make a living, so to speak, where we could kind of get out of the off of welfare and things like that. It seems today that not too many people are willing to try to do anything for themselves, or it seems that way to me, a lot of the people, but I never did like to take or ask for anything. I didn't want to be asking people to help me when I could help myself. So I lived in Delano till about 1945, 46. During that period of time, my husband and I separated. He was, as I say, part Indian. Now, I'm not sure that Indian had anything to do with it, but he didn't try to provide actually for us when we got over the depression, so to speak. He didn't seem to think, when he started making a little bit of money in the packing houses, he threw it away. He would go to the beer dives and play the slot machines and drink and come home drunk. And he wouldn't do anything for the family. He never tried to provide for us. And so finally I told him, my youngest son was 17, I mean, my oldest son was 17, and he was going to go into the service, and I told my husband, I said, now I'll make a living for the children, but I won't make a living for you any longer because you're throwing the money away, and I went through one depression with you, and I'll never go through another depression. If now, when you can make some money and do something with it and have a decent home, if you don't try to straighten up and help, then you're going to have to make a living for yourself from now on, and I'll make a living for my children. And so I divorced him. And then I moved to Bakersfield. And I worked in Kern County Hospital for almost 2 years, in 46 and 47, in the special diet department. And they didn't pay too much, $140 a month. But that was better than nothing at all, of course. But then, of course, prices began to rise along with that, and that didn't satisfy. I bought some slot machines. I mean, where you put nuts in there, those kind that you put nuts in on the counters of different places. Those vending machines, what I meant to say, not slot machines, but vending machines. And I had several places that I put those, which helped. And then I knew a man that that was, well, they called him a mud smeller, but he was did something in the oil fields trying to find land to lease to oil companies. And he had a little trailer court, and he let me collect the rents and take care of the trailer court. And I made, I think I got 20% of what that took in. And with that, and with the hospital work, I kind of made a fairly decent living for the children. And then my son came home from the service, and he married after that, right after that. And, of course, I survived. I keep saying I survived, but that was one of those things that you did, you know.
Yeah.
When we moved to Delano, before we moved to Delano, we had built a little house in the town of Pixley. I had sold the little house that I told you I paid $13 down on and $10 a month. I can't recall exactly, but I think I got $350 for it, and I took the $350 and bought a lot. And by picking cotton and cutting grapes, and the materials were real cheap at that time, and I had a friend whose husband was a carpenter, and he helped build us a little house. And as the years went on till 50, till about 45, it increased. But we left Pixley in 40, and I sold that place, and I got my husband sold it, let's put it that way. He sold the place for a Chevrolet car, a 40 Chevrolet car, and I think $250. So we moved to Delano.
Why did you move to Delano?
Well, it's kind of hard to say this, but I moved to Delano because my husband, he was always having strife in the home, and I felt embarrassed. I felt people didn't, you know, they don't like people that are always fussing in the homes. And I couldn't take that any longer. So he said, well, let's move to Delano. So he saw what we have, and we moved to Delano. And when we moved to Delano, he starts the same thing over again, you know, just doing things that the neighbors in the town would know about, like drinking and carousing and not working and making us look bad to the public. And so
you think alcoholism came out of the rough times that you all had?
Well, we always liked to make an excuse for him because he was raised, you might say, without a mother. His mother died when he was quite young, I think 6 or 8 months old, and then he had a stepmother till he was about 12, and then he was booted from his father and stepmother's place to the relatives and around and around and around, and so we always like to make an excuse for him. Of course, you'd think someone could outgrow that after
30 or 40 years, but some people never outgrow things, you know. They just can't get a handle on what's wrong with them, so I don't really know. But I do know that I couldn't raise my children respectably in that atmosphere, because you can't raise your children if every day they're hearing vulgarity and cursing and fighting and that sort of thing. And so after we'd built this little house in Pixley, he got drunk one day. He and his brother had come by, and they'd gone to Clark, and then he came back, and he started picked a fight. I was ironing. I was ironing him a white shirt, and he kicked my ironing board out from under the iron and really just started a fight for no reason, you know, just no reason at all. Didn't have any reason. And, of course, I had to have him arrested because I couldn't have him there and us fighting and the children, you know. Mm-hmm. And then this made me feel bad, because when you get out of when someone goes to the road camp or something and comes back, well, it does something to you. And it always scared the children. And I just couldn't have it. And about the only place I ever went at all was to church. And he'd say vulgar things about the preacher in the church and that sort of thing, you know. And eventually, when my little daughter got about 12 years old, and he began to say things to her that would hurt, like, you know, some men think that women, I guess, should crawl under the bed. They shouldn't be seen or heard. And I told him finally one day, I said, now, you've been talking this way to me, but you can't talk that way to my daughter. That's one thing I won't allow. And so with all the other things combined, I decided that I couldn't raise the children with him. That it was more important to raise the children and have them grow up to be somebody and be respected than to try to keep a home together in that atmosphere, and I couldn't take it any longer. And so I left him.
Is that when you came down to Bakersfield?
And I came to Bakersfield. I first went down in Imperial Valley. We had a little house, and I sold it. And when we moved to Delano, we took that $250 and bought a lot and started building another house. And with working out in the fields and places, I accumulated, he never helped, but I accumulated enough money to build us a little two-bedroom house after a fashion. I mean, it wasn't like you'd build today, well-built, but it was a little better than a lean-to. Mm-hmm. And when I sold that in Delano, I bought a trailer, we called them at that time, about a 27-foot trailer. And I had a car, and I latched on to that, and I took it down into the Imperial Valley where I thought I could trim lettuce, something that I knew to do to provide for the children. But when I got there, I hadn't been there long till he came, and he moved in the trailer. And so one day when he left, I backed up to the trailer, and I pulled it back to Bakersfield. And of course, he couldn't find me. I put it my trailer where he couldn't find me. He didn't know how to find me, and he went back to Delano, and I went to work in the hospital. And my oldest son at that time was in the service, and I had my daughter and the two sons at home. And she went to East Bakersfield High School, and the children was in grammar school. And then I worked in the hospital for about 2 years, and I couldn't... it seemed like that there wasn't enough money in the $140 that I could provide for the children, and I went to Edison and began to work in the potatoes, and I had learned while I was in Delano to pack tomatoes, and I packed piecework, and usually when you're working piecework and you're getting paid piecework, you're going to make more money than you do by the hour. And I really learned to pack fast. I became one of the best fruit packers. This isn't anything perhaps to some people to boast about, but there wasn't very many people that could do more than I did. And I usually after that I had a job. If anyone had a job in the country, I had one. And then when my children grew up to where I could go off and leave them at home, my two youngest boys, my daughter married then a man in Wasco, and then my two youngest sons, Mike and Pat, Mike went into the service, the Navy, and Pat was home. I would fill a refrigerator full of groceries and leave him at home, and he'd get himself to school, and I'd go up to Watsonville and pack tomatoes, and it became habitual with me to work. I'd work in Edison in the potatoes until the fruit started, and then I would go off and pack fruit. I had a regular round to make. I would go to up around Merced and pack tomatoes, and then in about the 10th of July I would go to Watsonville, and I would pack there till the pears would come on, and then I'd pack pears, and I'd go to Hood River, Oregon, and Medford, Oregon, and then later on I went up to Chelan, Washington, and then I would come home, and then of course the years passed and the children grew up, and my youngest son went to the service, and I went as far as Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and packed tomatoes. And eventually, they would always write and tell me when they were starting, so I wouldn't. I always got a letter through the. I was a union member, you know, and they notified me when we were starting and what day. Sometimes they'd miss a day or two, but anyway. I had a job then the year round, practically the year round. If I came home and didn't have for a month or two, I could draw a little unemployment until we started again. And this is the way I survived. Sounds strange, doesn't it?
What years would that have been when you were following the crops all over?
Well, that would have been around 49 to 56. I went to Florida in around 67. I was in Florida when Martin Luther King was killed. I was working in the tomato plant shed there when he was killed. I was working in the apricots in winters when Robert Kennedy was killed. And when Lillian, these are just high points that I remember where I was at. I was in the pears in Ukiah when Marilyn Monroe, you know, died. And, of course, I was in Bakersfield when John Kennedy died. I remember where I was at. These are just things that you kind of remember offhand. So if you know what years those were, you know.
What year did you start to follow the crops? That's when you said your son was in school.
The youngest?
The youngest one.
Well, I did this even before the other one, the one just older than him, but I didn't go and stay so long. I would go maybe to one town for a couple of 3 weeks and come back. Usually when I was in Bakersfield didn't pay any money. The farmers in Bakersfield wouldn't give you a living wage. I say this, and the boss that I work for, I talked to him one time. He said, Lillian, you people could get more money if you had asked for it. And I said, well, Gene, it was Gene Mettler, and he said they don't ask for it. And I said, well, Gene, the problem is with the women working in Bakersfield. A lot of the women working out there, their husbands have jobs. They have jobs in the phone company or in the gas company or something like that, and they're only out there to buy them some sheets and pillow slips and maybe a washing machine. And I said, it makes it very hard for a person who's providing for two children and buying the washing machine and paying the rent and things like this, you know. So usually in the springtime, I would have gotten behind with my house payments, say, for 3 months. And about 3 months is all you can get behind with a house payment. I usually tried to buy a home. I never wanted to rent. I can't recall ever renting any place excepting when I was away from home working, because I always tried to have a home. That's one of the things I tried to do. But I remember one time I bought this particular house on Monterey Street. It's down farther than where I live now, at 2816 Monterey, and I was behind three payments, and at the time it was a little early for the fruit, and I was going to lose the place. I was only paying $40 a month, but that was pretty strenuous for me with two children, and I was trying to send the kids to school, you know, and they weren't big enough to work or help or anything. And so I went to a man in Bakersfield. He was a lovely person, he and his wife. They run Ogle's Dress Shop in East Bakersfield, and most of the residents in Bakersfield know him. And I was telling him, someone had told me there was private people that would lend you money on a place and let you pay them. So I went to him and told him that I was about to lose it, and they only gave me another day or two. I've forgotten how much. And he said, "Mrs. Dunn, don't you ever let anyone tell you that you've only got a day or two to pay anything." Said, "You always make them wait a day or two." And he lent me the money on my property and let me pay him. And he realized, you know, then it made it easier, because I could get behind 3 months, and he knew that I would make it up just as soon as I got back on the job where they were paying me some money, see. And I think they've moved from here now. They're not here anymore. But he was a very lovely person.
When did you stop working in the fields?
I stopped working in the fields when I was in Delano. I went to the field one day. Well, I used to work in the packing house and the fields all at the same time. And you'd probably think that's kind of strange. But sometimes we'd work till 3 o'clock in the evening in the packing shed. And I would go out and wrap grapevines. You know, when they prune the grapevines, you have these long runners and you wrap them around the wires. And in the back of my car, I would put two balls of twine with a little bag that my kids could put around them. And when they got out of school, I got them a bicycle piece, and they bicycled out to the field. And I worked for a man. He was a real nice person, and I worked for him piecework. I wrapped his vines. Most people was working for 80 cents an hour. And I'd ask him if he would let me work piecework, because I worked in the packing shed till 3 o'clock, and I could come out and wrap vines after that. And the children could come out and tie them, because you wrap a little string around them, you know, and tie them. And he let me do that. And I worked by the thousand. Every thousand I got $13 and something for a thousand of those vines that I wrapped. And so that way I'd have two checks coming. I would have the one from the packing shed and the one from the fields, you know. And, well, I have been, not boasting, but I have managed.
Nobody could ever accuse you of being lazy.
No way.
But it was after Delano that you did go. Then you worked exclusively in the packing sheds when you were following the crops like the watermelon?
Yes. I started to say, the last time I worked in the field in the grapes, I went out to work in the grapes, and they have wasps in the grapes. And they have big wasp nests under those vines. And my little boys, they just hated that grape vineyard. And they knew that if I got stung by a wasp, that it would be all day, you know, so they stirred up the wasp. They went ahead of me somewhere and stirred up the wasp. And when I got up there, I got in a wasp nest, and they stung me. And I said, "Well, if that's the way you kids feel about it, I'll just not come back out here anymore." And that was my last day of grape cutting. But they really scare me, those wasps. You know, they just come out and they just cover you, you know, out of those things. Well, the kids didn't. They just wanted me not to do this, you know. They didn't want to get out there in the hot sand and the hot sun. And so that was my last working in the grape fields.
It sounds like you always had to kind of take your kids with you when you worked.
Oh, yeah. I took the youngest son to work, and we usually had a dog. And the dog took care of the boy. I could always tell where my baby was, because he was with the dog, and the dog wouldn't leave him, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took him to the field, and it breaks their heart today when they look back. Just Saturday night a week ago, my oldest son was down here, and he said, and it just hurts him so much. He said, I remember, he said, you weren't in them damn cotton fields. He remembers, you know. And when you look at it now and you look back and think, it was, at the time we didn't know any better. It was just a means of survival. But when you look back and you think of women and kids dragging a cotton sack up and down a row that's full of cotton, 85, 90 pounds, mm-hmm. pretty bad.
Yeah. What I meant with when did you quit working in the fields was when did you stop working, retire, or quit following the crops?
Oh, the last time I packed fruit was in Tehachapi. And it was in 74. Yeah, 1974. But I worked in Lake County before that, and then I came down and packed up in Tehachapi. But I just kind of got tired of doing that. mm-hmm. And then I started taking care of elderly people. I have just been off of a job since October. I worked 2 years and 2 months. I took care of a Charles P. Lake that runs the Rain for Rent here in Bakersfield. Mm-hmm. And he was an Englishman that came here from Canada. And he started the business, and he says when he got to Bakersfield, he only had a dollar in his pocket and two children. And he was... he said, and I was a very, very frightened man, you know, when he came to Bakersfield. But he was very nice, and he was a very nice person. He was blind, and I took care of him. He was 86 years old. His birthday is the 13th day of February, and mine was the 14th. And he's 87. He was 87 the 13th of this month, and I was 73 the 14th. But I worked for him 2 years and 2 months, and he paid me real well. He gave me $350 a week, which to me was a lot of money, and the board. And of course, I had a home. I had this was my home, you know, but I just locked it up and come over once in a while and watered the yard. I put in an automatic sprinkling system so I wouldn't have to worry about the yard being. And I have good neighbors, and I've got a lovely fire department behind me that takes care. They watch out after me real good. And so I never had anyone break in the home or anything for 2 years.
Anymore?
Oh, no. There's so many older people. I'm 73. Older people. Older people. I just finished taking care of a man about 2 weeks ago. He had gangrene in his feet, and he died. I took care of him on Monday night, and they took him to the hospital. He didn't want his feet took off, and that was operated, you know. And so he died before he would let him take off his feet. And he had gangrene so badly in his feet. I took care of him 3 or 4 weeks. And I took care of him on Monday night. They took him to the hospital Tuesday night, and he died on Wednesday. That's the last job I've had. Mm-hmm. And I just sit around and kind of wait for a job. And I mean, one person tells another about me, and someone needs me, they call me. Well, to some people, my life would probably be dull to them, but I really... well, I guess I'm used to it. And I like what I do. I like the way I mean now, the way I live. It's much easier than it has been.
I'll bet it is. I'll bet that when you look back and the times when you were trying to raise four kids and no washing machines, no running water, no electricity, that you just must feel like you've got a life routine.
Oh, yeah. This little place, there's so many people needing places to live now, and children can't buy themselves a home, and they can't hardly find anything they can rent with. And I contrived the idea. This garage was just full of junk that neighbors and friends would bring here and clutter it up with. And I thought, well, I'll turn the garage into me a little place to live, and I'll rent out the house, and that'll give someone else a place to live and me a place to live, and then I can run around and do as I please. It's small, and it doesn't look too much, but then I can close it up and go where I please because there's someone here to kind of look after things. And when I moved to this place in 1974, I set out fruit trees, and I've canned my own fruit ever since I've been here. Plums and peaches and pears and apples and apricots, cherries. That's the first thing I did, was put me out some fruit trees.
You worked in the fruit all day long and all your life, and you wanted to have fruit trees where you...
I wanted it of my own, yes. When I could go out, I didn't have to can three or four boxes at one time. I could go out and get one pail, as you say, and do that. Oh, yeah, it's... you know, there's a great reward to a person mentally when you think that you've been able to carry your own weight. And by that I mean you're able to stand on your own two feet and look the world into the face and say, I don't owe you a dime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to me like you've done that very...
That's what I've done, honey.
Very well. Let's go back for just a little bit and back to Pixley in the days when you were involved in the trying to organize the field workers. Did you feel like the unions were successful in organizing?
At that time, I didn't know too much about unions. The fact is, I didn't know anything about unions. I didn't even know how they operated or worked. All I knew was that we were working for 40 cents a hundred, and you couldn't survive on it. And it wasn't fair, and it wasn't right. And we were told that the farmers owed the finance companies, and they were not able to pay. That partially probably was true, that they owed the finance companies. But the finance companies, as I say, conspired against the people to get them to work for practically nothing. And somewhere or another, you have to break that. You've got to do something about that. You can't just keep on going down and down and down. You've got to come up. Sometimes they tell me there's no other way but up, you know. And so I did what I could. But when Cesar Chavez started to organize the people, you know Cesar Chavez? I was working in Lake County. And he called up there and asked the union lady if there was any lady there, any woman that they had there from back east, Oklahoma, or an Okie. So do you have anyone there that could talk to these Okies down here? He's a Mexican, you know, Caesar is. And she told him no, and about that time I walked in. It was a lunch period, and I walked in, and she run up. She said, oh, Lillian, I forgot about you. Don't you live around Visalia somewhere? And I said, no, I live around Delano. I live at Bakersfield. And she said, well, Cesar Chavez had just, the CIO had asked, was going to pay someone to help Cesar. She said, would you be willing? And I said, sure, I'd be willing. I came to this country with my pots and pans a-flying. So I went home and loaded up my things and come home. And I helped him organize DiGiorgio. And I helped him organize Jemima's. And I was with him and know him personally. Now, people don't like Cesar Chavez, but that's one of the loveliest people that you've ever met. And he and the girl negotiated the contracts, they would not give the farm laborers any unemployment. And they would not do anything for them. When they were off from work in the fields, they were out there having to get on welfare and get back on the taxpayers. And I felt like we were subsidizing the farmers by the taxpayers taking care of the people that they had worked for nothing all year. And these people had done what I had done. See, I had a kindred feeling for these people because I had been there. And when I came back to Delano, I mean Bakersfield, and the FLCI, I mean the CIO, paid me to help him. And I went, because I've never been a person that's really scared of anything. I don't know enough to be scared, I guess. But there was a lot of people on the Sierra Vista Ranch in Delano that the Mexicans couldn't talk to. And so I went there. And I went from house to house. And it was so surprising to the Mexican people that I did this because they were scared of these Okies. Because the Okies really had it in for the Mexicans, you know. The Okies. Now, I'm saying Okie. I don't mean it in a derogatory sense, but this is what the people are called, you know. And so I said, well, sure, I'll go out there. And I went from house to house, and I'd go in the house and sit down and talk to them. I said, look, you people are living on this ranch, and you're getting your house furnished, and you're getting your lights and gas furnished, and you don't have to pay, I said, to come to the fields. You walk out of your house and walk out into the fields. These people that you're trying to, you're running their wages down. These people have to pay for a place to live, and they have to drive back and forth to work, and they'd say, well, they called us scabs. I said, that's exactly what you are. And I would sit there and tell them. I said, and this is the word that you use for people that are running someone else's wages down, not caring for the other person while you are surviving. And, of course, I organize those people. I mean, they were part of me. I mean, and I understood what the Mexican people were going through with. Well, I just think the world is Cesar Chavez. I don't care who knows that, you know. I really don't care. Because he's a lovely person. I have known that man. And when he didn't, now they say, oh, he's living high on the hog, you know, and the other people, he's doing something. He didn't do that. I know that he didn't do that. I was there. Mm-hmm. I was there when the people left their bank jobs in San Francisco, and when they left their colleges, and when they left the universities, and they get them a pack on their back and come down to help him organize these farm workers. Mm-hmm. I was there. I was right in the house, right in the building where they didn't have room to hardly move their feet. There were so many of us and so many of them. And he wouldn't eat if there wasn't enough for everybody. He wouldn't eat. He wouldn't drink a soda water if there wasn't enough for everybody to go around.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that the real organization of the farm workers didn't come until Chavez came.
That's right.
That although there were strikes and attempts to organize back in the 30s, that they weren't too successful.
They weren't too successful.
Do you have any thoughts about why those organization efforts in the 30s weren't so successful?
Well, truly, Cesar Chavez is a person that has worked in the field like I have. Mm-hmm. And you can't organize somebody if you don't know what they're doing. I mean, what they have had to go through. You can't say, well, this they're doing or that they're doing when you've never experienced it. The only reason that I could organize the people and help to organize the people is because I had been there. By being there, I mean I had done what they were doing. I had suffered what they were suffering. I knew how far their money went, you see, and how their children had to live, and how their children were shunted from one school to another. And how I even went down in Florida and helped them in Florida when I was there.
When you say that... do you think that the people who were trying to organize in the 30s were not farm laborers themselves?
They were not farm laborers. They were people it was more political. And by this I mean, these people seen the hurt and knew what was going on. However, they were more educated, more an educated class. And they had not experienced the trauma of trying to make a living in the fields. However, they wanted to help. They did everything that they knew to do. And I loved them, too. Pat Chambers and Carolyn Decker. They've probably forgotten all about me. Mm-hmm. But my son is named after Pat Chambers. Mm-hmm. Pat Dunn is named after Pat Chambers. Mm-hmm. And Mike Dunn is named after Mike Kearney, the man that posted bail for me. That's where they got their name.
So you think that they, although their intentions were good, that the people didn't really think that they knew what it was like? Or
well, I think the farm people knew, but having never struck before, no one had ever tried to organize cotton pickers, because you've got a field here and maybe 4 miles over there you've got another one. While you're over there at that field, someone can be slipping in over here picking cotton, see? It's not like a store or the PG&E where you can and got one building and the people are in that building and you can walk back in front of the door and see who's going in.
Yeah.
They've got more access and more space to scab on you. And if they see you coming, they can drop down in the tomato fields or in the cotton fields or grape vineyards and you can't see them. And if they're not allowed to go in, which they tried to bar Caesar and them from going in, you know, they tried to bar him. But when we tried to organize the cotton pickers, we had caravans. And the law enforcement officers were against us also. I hate to say this, because they were paid by the taxpayers, of course. And they were paid to come by and throw dust on us in the gullies and things. And they just have plumes of dust. We'd be just like, we would be covered with dirt and dust when the evening come. And they were paid to keep us out any way they could. And so while we would be going down the road, they would run into the dirt and stuff with their cars and throw dirt and stuff on us with the wheels of the cars, you know, and intimidate us. As we drove down the road, well, they would be following along behind and just as close as they could and sometimes go around us and get in front of us and things like that. They intimidated the people. And then when they were allowed to shoot and kill the people, we really began to know that what it was like, what we were really up against. At first, you wouldn't think that. I couldn't imagine anyone killing anyone, you know, or shooting them, or being even. To me, the law enforcement was supposed to be for everybody, and you can't imagine that. That they're going to be told before they leave their office in the morning, you divert the traffic for 2 blocks. And they did this. I'm not lying to you, and I'm not making it up. And I can tell you the house they passed by Kegel's house 2 blocks or more away from the highway. And they would turn off before they got into the lane, or they were diverted by the highway patrol. And those people were allowed to shoot. And then when they were brought to trial, they camouflaged the trial and made it look like the strikers did it. And when I tell you this, you can believe it, because I'm not going to lie about it. It's the God's honest truth.
I believe you. I think that some pretty violent things went on during that time.
It did.
Did you stay active in the labor movement after that experience, or did you kind of taper off until you started to help Cesar Chavez?
Well, I had to join the union when I went to working in the packing houses. There was no union in Delano, but there was unions in Watsonville and Salinas.
That was in the 40s, right?
Mm-hmm. And when they came, you see, those packing house workers would come from Salinas just as a group to work in Delano. That's why I had such a hard time getting a job. Is because the Delano people couldn't get a job. They came from where they had been used to doing this, bringing the packers and the trimmers with them. And, of course, a local person didn't have a chance to get a job. And I just barely got it by going down there and telling the man that I wanted, you know, and he realized that I needed a job, and he was very nice about it. But
when you go... Think back to the time that your kids were going to school. in the 30s in Pixley. I know that you said Saturday that you were known as the redheaded agitator, but and you mentioned a few minutes ago that kids were shunted around from one school to the other. Did you ever think that your kids were treated differently than the local kids while they were in school?
My son, the oldest one, my little daughter had just started to school my little daughter was 2 years old when they had the strike and when they were calling me names. And I was pregnant with Mike when I was in jail, about 4 months. And of course he wasn't born yet when that happened, you know. But Jay was starting to school and he was quite young. He was about 6 years old. And of course he didn't tell me. I didn't realize at the time it was happening. It's years later now that he tells me. Even now he tells me what they did to him, see. And all these years, a lot of this I didn't know. Because I would have been the first one down there to that school had I known that he was being mistreated by anybody. But because his mother was a communist and an agitator, as they call me, they mistreated him. And my little daughter, she never did tell me much about it, if they ever mistreated her or not. I guess she was really too young to know. When you go to school at 5 years old, you really don't know exactly what they, or why they're doing anything to you, you know. But I've even went to church. I've even went to church, and you know, those poor, silly people in church will call you a communist. Don't even know the difference. They don't even know. I went to church down in Lamont one time. They've got a great big church there now. And I've known the people quite a while. And because I wouldn't pay those people tithes, they wanted me to pay them 10% of what I made, and I didn't have no 10% to give those people. I was doing well to make a living. And they asked me if I was a communist. If I believed in having all things common like that, said, why didn't I sell what I had and give it to the poor? I was poor as Job's turkey myself. And you wouldn't believe the preachers preach against communism when they don't even know what communism is. Because it's a brainwashed thing. You know, you don't realize that people are brainwashed on communism. I even worked one time in a place where we made cooler pads. And this one woman was talking, and she didn't want Ronald Reagan to be a governor of California because he's a communist. And I said, my God almighty, what's wrong with you, woman? You're calling Ronald Reagan a communist. I said, he's calling everybody else communist. What's wrong with you? Well, isn't it the truth?
It seems like it's very popular, and I think it was popular back then, to call anybody who doesn't agree with your political ideology a communist.
Or even if they get out and steal something and they're kind of down in the gutter someplace, they're communist. I know people that... I finally got sick of just listening at people's ignorance on communism. My.
Back in those days, was there time for any kind of recreation or free time, or was it all pretty much work?
It was all work. There was no play along then. If you had any time to play, you had no clothes to wear and no money to go, so what difference did it make? If you were out of work, well, you were in misery because you didn't know where your next meal was coming from. You didn't know how you were going to pay your light and gas bill. And then when you went to work, you were so happy to get to work, you never thought about pleasure. Mm-hmm. I guess it's kind of become a habit with me to call me a workaholic. But really, it doesn't bother me to work. It doesn't bother me. I just want to be able to handle whatever I have to handle, you see.
Did you ever... live in those government camps that were, you know, around Arvin and I think up around someplace around Corcoran. I've forgotten the exact city. There were some government camps.
Well, I went to one, I don't know whether you call it a government camp or not. I guess it must have been because they had showers in there and toilets in this particular place. A friend of mine was going, before I ever learned to grade potatoes, and she said, well, Lillian, go with me down to Edison, and that's where I first learned about Gene Mettler. He was a very fine person. But he wouldn't give me a job because I had never grade potatoes. So I went out in the field. I said, well, we had a tent. So we lived in this tent. We had a bed springs and a bed and some kind of a stove, I've forgotten what. And we lived in this tent, and we're supposed to live in this tent. I stayed 2 days. At that time, I lived in Delano. And I went out to pick up potatoes. Lord, I'd never picked up a potato before, and that is a job. You know, you drag the sack between your legs and you get this sack about half full of potatoes, and you sink 50 pound, and you drag it up, and you sit it down, you know, and jostle those potatoes down, and you grab another sack and hook it on. And that first day, I made it pretty good because I wasn't sore. And I went in and took a shower. The next evening, I went back out that next day, and I was picking up potatoes, and I got home that evening. Oh, I was so tired, and I was sore from. And I got in the men's shower. I didn't know I was. They had one shower here, women's, and the next was men's. And I was just showering away, and I was meditating on a handle that someone had tore off before you turn the water. I thought, well, I was in this very one yesterday evening, and they have torn that off already, and I was soaking wet. And I heard some men coming in. I said, my Lord, no wonder I'm not in the right one. So I tried to get my clothes on me, and I was wet. Could you imagine putting your clothes on you and wet it? You know? And I dashed out. I said, excuse me, I'm in the wrong pew. And I just went, and I went out and got my things and put them in the car and went home back down to Delano. I thought, that's enough of that. I can't do any more of that. That would have had to have been about 44.
So in all the time that in the 30s and the early 40s, you always managed to put a little money down on a house and have a house that you were buying.
Yes, you didn't have to have anything like you have today, so don't compare it with what you're having to do today. Actually, I bought a lot from a person in Delano. I think I gave $50 for it. And the house, the material and all, I got for about $250. We hauled it from Porterville. And I think the man built what he built of it for about $150. So you can imagine what kind of house. We didn't seal it at first. We just put the outer boards up. We didn't put anything on the inside. You could lay your comb and brush and things on the two befores inside that connected it together. Anyway, it was better than a tent, some. Great.
Yeah. You've lived an interesting, remarkable life. You really have. During all of this time, I'm noticing your Bibles here. During this time, did you ever stop believing in the church or in the teachings, or stop going to church because of what was happening?
I don't attend churches now. I don't belong to any church. I don't believe you have to belong to a church. Any church. I believe that when you come to Jesus Christ and you're baptized in His name, you're in the body of Christ. And there's nothing that can take you out, and nothing but the Spirit of God that can put you in. I don't think that you come to the Lord and he saves you or takes you into his body. I mean, the body that, and by the body of Christ, I mean a body of believers that really believe the truth. And you take that person and then take him out and join him to an organization. I don't think that's it. I don't believe that's it. I don't believe the Bible teaches that that's it.
Is this the way that you've felt for a long time, or is this something you've come to recently, or what?
No, I found the Lord when I was 13 years old in a Brush Arbor meeting in the town of Hanna, Oklahoma. And I guess all of my life I have had this feeling about the Lord. Even in the storms in Oklahoma, when they would have cyclones, I would always feel that the Lord would take care of me. And he healed me one time when I was about 15 years old of chills. I never took medicine, and when I read the Bible said that he would heal you, I figured that he told the truth, you know. And so when I had chills, and I had them very bad, I had them terribly bad, they, malaria, because we had a cistern and we drank water out of the cistern and it was polluted. And of course, I didn't know that was what was causing it. But I sent for the people to come to pray for me. And I thought when I sent for them that they would just drop everything and come over, but they didn't. So I finally got over the chill and I was shaking the bed down, you know, like this. And they came and they prayed for me, and the lady said, come go home with us. And so I got up and out of the bed and put on my clothes and went home with them. And I never did have a chill from that day to this. Never had another chill. No symptoms of a chill. Believe this when I tell you. I never had a chill from that day to this. I believe that because the Lord said, if you call for the elders of the church and let them anoint him with oil and the prayer of faith will save the sick and the Lord will raise him up. And of course, I believe that. Mm-hmm. And believe's what does it, you know. Whatsoever man thinketh, so is he. So he healed me, and I've never had another chill. And I don't run to doctors all the time and take medicine like some people. I believe that Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness for the people to look upon to be healed. And Jesus said, now if I be lifted up, I'll draw all men to me. And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. And so he was lifted up. And when he lifted up, he took in all nations. Not just the Israelites, but all nations.
When did you, when did you actually decide to stop affiliating with an organization, or has that been the pattern that you've had all your life?
I never joined a church in my life. My mother had me baptized or sprinkled in the Methodist church when I must have been about 5 or 6 years old. But I couldn't understand how if I'd known the Lord for 3 or 4 or 5 years before they organized the Assemblies of God. That was the first church that I had knowledge of them organizing when it was organized in Dustin, Oklahoma. I went with some people up there to that, and a lot of them joined the Assemblies of God from Springfield, Missouri. Their home place is in Springfield. But I must have been about 15, and I didn't join. I, no one asked me to, but if they had, I would not have, because I didn't see any reason why I should. If it was all right without it, why should I join it, you know? And when I came to California, and I went to the Assemblies of God Church in Pixley, they wanted me to join there, and I wouldn't. And they kept nagging at me to join their Assemblies of God, and they gave me different reasons why I should. But I told them I didn't want to put my name on their book. So finally the preacher said, well, he'd like to put my name down on his book because so he'd know who all was coming there. He gave me a kind of a offhand excuse. And I told him if he wanted the name on the book to put it down. But it wasn't long after that he told me to take it off. And I told him, I said, well, now you put it down, you take it off. And so he finally rubbed it off. But it never bothered me because I understood. because sometimes you're right and sometimes you're wrong, and when you're wrong, you're just wrong all the way, and he was just wrong all the way.
If you look back over the whole experience of living through the migration to California and the hard times during the Depression and the years of the 30s, do you think that living through that time had a long-lasting or any kind of a permanent effect on you as a person?
As a Christian?
As a person.
As a person. Well, the things that happened to the children has hurt. It hurts. And you'd think maybe I'm feeling sorry for myself, but I'm not. It just hurts to think that people can be like this. You know, that they can... It really hurts to think that you don't understand people when they need desperately, you know, I'm sorry for them.
It seems like that experience is still extremely painful for you to think about and to talk about. The hurt is so deep.
Well, actually, I think the thing that hurts so bad is seeing your children hungry. Actually, my baby died, you know.